Stories have to be told or they die. And when they die, so does that which defines their significance. Etched in Stone is a collection of stories about unparalleled athletic achievements, discipline, and commitment of the distinguished members inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.
We are back with the second episode of Legend on the Rocks. I'm Terry Shockley. We continue Legend on the Rocks as Lee Kemp goes to college with an ambition so big he keeps it to himself. He plans on being a four-time NCAA wrestling champion. Rescued at birth from what could have been a life in the Cleveland inner city, and then thrust into a complete white world, Leroy Kemp found the equalizer in wrestling.
He went from very, very black Cleveland to very, very white Chardon.
His competitiveness was off the charts. His psychological acceptance of the challenge of the level he was at, his personal drive to be exceptional.
Former teammate, NCAA champion and Olympian, Jim Haynes.
But he knew his body, he knew how much he needed to do to be successful, and he was very deliberate in how he planned and prepared to win.
I mean, you know, would he ever miss practice? No. Would he ever be out of shape? No. Would he ever not be prepared mentally for the match or physically? No.
His core position was ideal. He never conceded hip position on anything. And what people don't realize is not so much his speed, but his quickness. His reaction to things was instantaneous, and it was full power.
Most wrestlers' first choice is not wrestling. Leroy's first choice was basketball. But the coach didn't see a future for Lee knocking down threes and going to the basket. He approached Leroy's high school coach with a suggestion that wrestling might be a better fit.
He came up to me after practice when he says, you know, I've got this young man on my team, good athlete, he's not a really good basketball player.
He started slowly and improved steadily. However, the inspiration that he would use to become one of the world's greatest wrestlers didn't come until after his junior year, and it would come from someone who had inspired generations of wrestlers. Leroy would begin to mix new technique and live wrestling with an obsessive training regime, which capped a high school career with a state championship and a rare victory over a Russian. Kemp had many choices on where he would go to college. His choice would further define his character and contribute to the legacy he was building. Dwayne Clevin was raised 20 miles from where he would eventually make his mark as a college coach. He graduated from Stoughton High School in 1957, going 50-3. But he did not win the state title. He wrestled at Wisconsin, but was not good enough to get a scholarship. So he went to work his senior year coaching Wisconsin High School. After a two-year stint in the infantry, he took the job as the head wrestling coach at Racine Park.
We had a decent year. You know, I took one kid to the state tournament my first year, but I got a bus, and I bused the entire squad up to Madison to watch the state tournament.
He won his first and second state championship after his first year of coaching. Wisconsin was looking for a coach, and Elroy Hirsch, the athletic director at the time, said the coach had to be from Wisconsin.
I got a football coach I hired from Illinois. I got a basketball coach from Indiana. The wrestling coach has got to be from Wisconsin.
Clevin remembers Hirsch's charge. He got the job, but it was a challenge.
They didn't have any money. You had to come there and earn a scholarship. Everybody was a walk-on. Russ's senior year, he was the only one that went to the Nationals, and George couldn't even afford to go with him.
That George was another National Wrestling Hall of Fame inductee from Wisconsin. George Martin. Martin is credited with establishing the Wisconsin State High School programs, but the challenge Clevin faced taking over at Wisconsin was considerable. He started at an $11,500 salary and quickly set out to secure an assistant coach. Part of being a great leader is identifying talent. Clevin landed a star.
Our total budget was $17,000, and that included my salary. Now, that didn't include the NCAA tournament.
He didn't have to go far to find his star. Both Russ Hellickson and Clevin grew up in Stoughton. Russ's life's workout on the farm was more difficult than workouts for the world championships.
One year we had close to 80 acres of tobacco, which is very labor-intensive. It probably impacted my life more than anything, I think. When I used to get into training camps in the 70s, and I was in a lot of them, I thought I was on vacation.
Hellickson did not start wrestling until he was a junior. Placing in the state as a senior, he walked on in Wisconsin, but would not realize his potential until 1970.
I won the Midlands tournament in the end of 1970. I got a letter to come and train with the Mayor Daley Youth Foundation. The most powerful force in our human universe is influence. And I was fortunate to be influenced by very positive, productive, caring people. And at different times in my life, impacted different aspects of my psyche. But the thing that changed my international was Terry McCann and Doug Blueball, who were both Olympic champions in 1968.
He looks back on the first practice in a McCann wrestling room.
I didn't even know what the rules were for international wrestling. And the first day I went into practice, I met Terry about probably 10 minutes before the practice started. And he introduced me to two guys. He literally had 40, 45 minutes of a very intense warm-up. And I literally thought it was the practice for the day, and it was only the warm-up. We wrestled for about, I think, 35 or 40 minutes, and I never scored a point. I got the living tar beat out of me. Then a hand was on my shoulder again, and it was Terry. And he told me, yeah, tough day. And I said, yeah, tough day, coach. I'm sorry. And he said, you don't really know who you were wrestling today. Bill Harlow just came back from the World Championships. He was a silver medalist in freestyle. And Willie is a multiple Greco-Roman national champion. And in 3 months, I went from being not understanding what freestyle was to winning the national Greco and placing second in the national freestyle. And then that summer, I won the first Pan Ams and took a bronze medal in the world.
Hellickson would add more national and international titles to his resume while he began his coaching career at Wisconsin. The two Stoughton and UW grads strategized on how to get the program on the move. Clevin was a recruiter, promoted the program on campus, and organized practices. Hellickson was a technician, freestyle coach, and connected well with everyone on the challenges of achieving lofty goals like an NCAA title. Wisconsin had yet to win an individual NCAA title. The first thing they did was to dramatically upgrade the schedule by adding Iowa State, Oklahoma State, Oklahoma, and creating a tournament on their own campus, the Northern Open. In 1975, Kemp had lofty goals that his high school career didn't support.
My freshman year in college, my goal was to be a four-time national champion. It had never been done before. I mentioned that to Dwayne. He just kind of tried to say to me, Lee, that's not really going to happen.
Clevin and Hellickson had regimented practices. This was not Iowa State. Lee had his own schedule, which meant showing up for practice on what was to become known as Kemp time.
I'm not proud of saying this now, but I can remember my freshman year, we'd be practicing, and then, you know, it'd be the time in the practice where coaches wanted us to go run or something like that. I don't want to run. I want to keep drilling. We were like at the standoff. I remember that. Dwayne just let me drill. I don't know, 7 o'clock. I was still rolling around with somebody. I think he got it. I think he understood that I was different, you know, but he just allowed me to just find the end of myself or something like that.
Clevin would spend 4 years giving Lee the freedom he needed to pursue his dream his way.
I'll never forget one night he came in the room and I could tell he was in a bad mood. So he came up and he said, "What are we doing?" I said, "We're going to drill single leg." He said, I don't want to. I said, "Kemp, you're going to drill single leg like everybody else." He said, "Coach, I'm not like everybody else." I said, "You know something? You're right. Go wrestle with Russ." We wrestled the whole practice with Russ. Like Mrs. Kemp told me, "I'm going to tell you one thing, Coach Clevin, it don't do no good to argue with Leroy." She was absolutely right.
Kemp developed a solid leg attack and a foundation of technique to go with a loaded, talented, hardworking wrestling room that gave him all he could handle.
We had a competitive room. I can remember working out with Ed Batch. I used to work with Russ sometimes. And it wasn't, you know, he didn't use his weight, but he's a guy that Olympic team, Olympic silver medalist.
Batch wrestled at 177 pounds. His senior year, he beat Chris Campbell in the Big Ten Finals. Unfortunately, in the match, he tore ligaments in his knee. That ended his college career. Campbell won the first of his two NCAA titles that year. There were others. 1976 NCAA champion Pat Christensen, All-American Steve Lovinger, and 1977 NCAA champion Ron Yeady. And both Olympic gold medalists, John and Ben Peterson, would make regular appearances in the room. But Kemp's greatest tools came from Russ Hellickson's philosophy and technique. In the late 70s, no one in the country emphasized freestyle and international competition like Wisconsin. UW wrestlers weren't waiting to graduate to train for international competition. It was how they trained collegiately. Very few UW wrestlers were able to or even tried to ride their opponent. Their calling card was everything that came off of their feet. Hellickson taught a series on your feet that fit like a glove for Kemp's conservative style. The single leg and all the options off of it was what defined UW's amazing rise from obscurity. Hellickson also emphasized controlled tie-ups, enabling Kemp to stop anyone who thought about shooting on him. This enabled Kemp to use his athletic ability with his new superior technique to win immediately. Next to the Midlands, the Northern Open became the toughest regular season tournament. Iowa, Iowa State, and a slew of great wrestlers like Ben Peterson and Russ Hellickson entered. Kemp would get a look at his competition to win four titles.
Anybody could be there. And you don't see that today, really, in college tournaments. That was like a chance to show myself how good I was.
He would meet Iowa's Chuck Yeagla for the first of five times that year in the finals, winning in overtime. In the Midlands, he lost to Bob Holland, who beat Chuck Yeagla in a close match in the finals. He placed sixth.
My evaluation of all that is that I'm real close. I'm right up there toward the top.
Kemp would lose two more times to Yeagla before the NCAA finals in 1975. Kemp's strength was on his feet. Yeagla on top, riding.
He adjusted a little bit, and maybe that comes from coaching. He made sure there wasn't going to be a takedown. So when I wrestled him in the dual meet, there was no takedown.
Kemp didn't have an easy path to the finals. In his first match, he went into overtime before beating Mike Taylor by a referee's decision. In the semifinals, he won a second overtime match against Pete Galea, who had beaten Yeagla.
I just thought he was better than Chuck, but anyway, I finally get by him, and that was a nice victory because, I just didn't think he was better than me, but the match just ended up in a tie again, you know? Now you got to go overtime. My conditioning was good, and that was from back in high school, the mentality of training, learning from Gable, so I was always in great shape.
Kemp would learn a valuable lesson.
It's almost like planning for the finals and you lose first round because you're already looking ahead. Boy, I was thinking, I'm not gonna be a four-timer. That's what I was thinking. I shoved it to the side, and then it came down to, I got to get this takedown. And to the whole point of that, bringing that up, is that, yeah, you have the long-range goal, but you have to, it's got to be what's happening right now.
Kemp found himself one match away from achieving the first of his four-part collegiate goal. He was in the NCAA finals, wrestling who else? Chuck Yagler.
I knew that I had to take him down. If I was going to win that match, I had to get a takedown. I knew that I couldn't shoot underneath him because he's so long. If I didn't get an angle, that's when he would drape, get an ankle, take, you know, do cross face curl, take you down, and you couldn't get away. So I snapped him down. I was real good with a snap down. And he was pushing, and I could sense he was a little off balance. When I say snapped him down, he must have hit his head off the mat or something. It was the finals. I knew that I had to do something different. And that takedown was what I needed. And then Chuck knew what he needed. He needed to ride me and get riding time. And that's what took the match in overtime. I was winning 4-3, and he had riding time. I don't know how much more riding time, but hindsight now is I should have tried to ride him. Even if I was hanging on to his shoelaces to get that minute riding time, that could have changed the whole match. And during regulation and in all those previous matches, I rode him in the overtime for a minute because the match was on the line. If I didn't ride him, then I didn't think I could win. But I did, during regulation, I got away. I rode him and he rode me. So I had never ridden him before. So he rode me the whole second period. So now the third period, I'm on top. I have no choice but to ride him just so it'd be tied again. I couldn't let him go. He switches. I'm barely hanging on. Man, I'm doing stuff I never knew I knew how to do. And then at the very end, he gets up on his feet, switches again. He cuts away, and I'm dropped down on a double leg. And then right when the buzzer ends, he falls on his hip again.
John Bartas has his opinion.
In my humble opinion, if you watch the Yagler-Kemp NCAA championship final match as a freshman, I don't see any way that you give a referee's decision to anybody other than Lee. So I think he maybe didn't get a break on the scoring, and save for that, he would have been a four-time NCAA champion, because from my perspective, he got nothing but better from there.
If you ask anyone from Wisconsin, they will tell you Kemp won the match. If you ask anyone from Iowa, they will tell you Yagler won. If you ask 100 unbiased fans, it's 70-30 in favor of Kemp. But then, I'm the Wisconsin announcer. He lost a match by split decision that inevitably would deny his opportunity to be the first four-time NCAA wrestling champion. What would be the most important thing Kemp would learn from his first NCAA tournament? Focus on scoring one point at a time and not on the potential outcome.
So I was always able to focus to where I need a point right now. And I could always get a point right now.
Kemp would not be a four-time NCAA champion, but he still had lofty goals with a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Let's take a break with a message from one of wrestling's legends. When we come back, Lee Kemp goes on a record-breaking tear through his final three college seasons and even beats his hero.
This is Lee Kemp, a distinguished member inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1990. And you are listening to Etched in Stone, stories of wrestling's legends. Etched in Stone is written and produced by wrestlers, about wrestlers, who tell these stories with enthusiastic energy and have a unique perspective, enabling them to extract stories from legends that wrestling fans want to hear. Don't miss a single episode, as the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling bring these stories to life. USA Wrestling provides quality opportunities for its members to achieve their full human potential and athletic potential and strives to be the world's best sports organization. To learn how you can become a member and download a complimentary storybook of all distinguished member stories, go to teamusa.org.
In the third year of existence, the Northern Open was loaded. Olympic gold medalist John and Ben Peterson, silver medalist Russ Hellickson, two-time NCAA champ Carl Adams, and Dan Gable. Not to mention a full teams from Iowa, Iowa State, and Wisconsin. All of that would be overshadowed by the finals at 158 pounds.
I didn't think I was going to beat him, by the way. I mean, there's no way.
Kemp, referring to Dan Gable, the man he worshipped and used to inspire the lofty goals that he set for his own march to gold.
Dan taught me to understand what your strengths were. And he talked about it at that camp when I was in high school.
Kemp knew his own strength, and as the match grew closer, he became more confident.
I knew I was strong. You know, I knew I was, say, athletic. I guess you can use that word, athletic. And conditioning was something you could work on. And I always was in great shape. I knew I was in really good shape. And I was very confident in the technique that I knew how to do. I mean, I didn't venture outside of the technique that I was really good at.
His two roommates didn't help his confidence much.
I remember one time, you know, you getting ready to, where me, him, and Mike Terry live in the region, room 333. So, you know, he's going to go wrestle in the finals, Dan Gable. And I looked at him and said, well, you know, I hope you don't get pinned. He looked at me and says, Jim, I think I can beat him.
I just felt that I wanted to at least perform better than what I saw these other people.
Others were trying to ease the fall of an inevitable loss.
Dwayne, meaning no disrespect to Coach, but he didn't want me to wrestle Gable, really. I guess he thought it would have crushed my confidence and I would not have been the same guy after that.
Well, Russ and I both had the same thoughts. You know, we're going to get them in different brackets because we did the seeding alone, just the two of us, and they'll meet in the finals and Kemp will lose and it'll be good for him. And that was our whole thing. So it's the finals and we go there to the mat and Kemp shows up in his blue junior world or whatever singlet. And I looked at him and I know my first thought was, he didn't come here to lose. Russ looked at me and said, I think it'd be better if he lost for everybody. That's what Russ said. I said, I don't think that's his plan. He won the match.
The UW Fieldhouse was packed. As the match began, Kemp's impenetrable stance made it difficult for Gable to get anything going. Gable pushed and tried to tie up Kemp and took a few weak shots. On his third attempt, Kemp saw an opening and taking a single leg, which must have stunned Gable because Kemp took him down easily. 2-0, Kemp. A stunned but ecstatic crowd came alive. Gable escaped. 2-1. In the second period, Kemp was down and escaped rather easily. 3-1, Kemp. What was going on? Gable must have been thinking the same thing as he started a barrage of shots that ended up in a takedown. All tied, 3-3. Gable rode hard, but not hard enough. Kemp escaped for a 4-3 lead. In the third period, Kemp rode Gable just enough to eliminate writing time. Gable did escape, and now the scoreboard read 4-4. On their feet, Gable pushed and stretched a bit too long on a low single. In an intuitive move Gable never saw coming, Kemp stepped over the outstretched arm, hooked a leg, and took Gable to his back. Not long enough for back points, but a takedown. Kemp now 6-4.
Well, the part of that match that was the most important was the last 30 seconds, because he had a chance to win the match, and this also was another point in the match. I had this move that I used to do. I would step over a guy. When I have a whizzer, I step over a whizzer. You're always told not to do that. I have the arm underneath, and Yanni Diakomihalis does a move like that now too, a current wrestler. I was stunned that it worked kind of on him.
Cable quickly reversed Kemp. All tied at 6-6. The crowd is now in a frenzy. Kemp escaped. Kemp, 7-6. Gable mounted a relentless attack on his feet, shooting a strong single that Kemp pulled up on. Kemp, with only an armbar, held Gable off for 20 seconds.
The last 30 seconds, man, he shoots in relentlessly, finally gets, and because he was so relentless, and I wasn't going out of bounds, and I was in the middle of the mat, they couldn't call me for stalling. Gable was so aggressive that he was trying to take me down, so he's got me in a bear hug, and they couldn't call me for stalling because I'm just whizzing, and I just wouldn't let him have it. And that's focus.
That was it. Kemp had beaten his idol 7-6.
When Gable got on his leg, he had wrestled single leg himself.
I just remember Russ looking at me and saying, you know, he may never lose again. You know something? You could be right.
Kemp would go on to win his first NCAA title that year.
Lee Kemp, who defeated Dan Gable on Dan's comeback trail, has won the NCAA 158-pound championship over previously undefeated Tom Brown of Washington. And the final score would be 4-0.
What made Kemp this good?
Lee was a student of the sport. So in fairness, as a starting point, he had an unquenchable thirst to get better. And so his work ethic was reflected in his results. So he simply, as a wrestler, as a champion wrestler at the world level, he had no weaknesses in his game. His work ethic was unbelievable. His genetics were the best you can possibly see in a human being. His conditioning, his quickness, he had no weaknesses. And I was watching him with Chris Campbell and Mark Chiarella, two pretty good wrestlers. Chris had, I believe, received the most outstanding technical wrestler in the world championships that year as a world champion in 81. And Lee did not give up a single takedown against either of those two guys. And I watched them go for almost an hour, not one.
He was independent, but he intuitively understood what he needed to do.
There's more to winning at this level in college than working hard and talent. You have to show up focused and prepared for every match. Kemp did not have a lot of interests outside of wrestling and school. Mike Terry and Jim Hansen, both All-Americans at Wisconsin, roomed with Kemp and recall the other side of wrestling in college.
He was just a real balanced guy. And he just took care of his business. He was a good, strong student in a real strong major. He was a business school major with a real heavy workload, school workload. And that took a tremendous amount out of him. That was a full day for him. 3 o'clock would roll around. It's time for wrestling practice. And you know, nobody could wrestle like he did in practice. He could go forever. And he did. And he'd go home. He'd eat, study hard for a couple hours. My sophomore year, we had gone to the Oklahoma. So we were gone for about, I don't know, must have been gone for about a week. Well, he came home and he had a lot of homework. Well, he had that managerial economics course and he had a calculus 500 course. He just locked himself in the room and banged out all that homework and banged out all that study and took all the tests. He had that kind of discipline. And that was the kind of rigor that was demanded by business school at the time. And somehow he was able to do that and just work out and wrestle more than anybody.
Lee did enjoy himself, but his good behavior angel always won.
Did everything together. We were on campus together all the time. Specifically, now Leroy is just not going to do anything stupid. He never did anything that was inappropriate or careless. It just wasn't his nature.
I lived with him for 2 years, and I knew him in high school.
I never saw the guy take a drink, be drunk, or do all the things all the other college kids do. He was 100% committed.
There are so many distractions on a campus like the University of Wisconsin. Being a major in business demands a lot of time and focus. Then there's all the temptations of State Street and the partying part of campus life. And girls. How many gifted and talented athletes lose their focus and priorities falling in love?
The time constraint isn't that much because really, when you think about it, you want to spend time with somebody like someone that you love. You can kind of have fun with, have them maybe make food for you or just make you feel good. I'd have a girlfriend for a couple months. But then when the season started, I just they'd call. And this is before cell phones. My goodness, I don't know how I would have handled that, always being on call.
He dated a few girls, but there wasn't a priority.
The rest of his college career was about as eventful as one of his matches. However, in 1978, Kemp was wrestling at 158 pounds, but so was a junior from Michigan and then already a one-time NCAA champion and was third as a freshman. Mark Chiarella in a Michigan newspaper called Kemp out.
It was finally about time that I was going to wrestle Mark. He stayed at 50 for 2 years. So now he's at 58, beginning of the year of 58. I think that if you really wanted to wrestle him, he should have entered the Northern Open. Because at one point, Coach Duane was thinking, well, be prepared that Chiarella might enter the Northern Open just to test you to see where you're at. And so I was ready, but he didn't enter the Northern Open. And the Northern Iowa tournament didn't enter that.
Had Chiarella changed his mind? No one was sure.
When I'm thinking, man, I would have rather wrestled him earlier. So then I could have adjusted and whatever, but now it's at the end. I think it was like the week before the Big Ten tournament. It was the last duel before the national tournament. And this is one of those coaching things where Duane kind of allowed me to, I said, Coach, I don't think it's in my best interest to wrestle Mark now. And he's looking at me like, man, you wrestled Gable and everybody. Why don't you? I said, because it's at this point, man. I said, what if he beats me, man? He's going to be at 58 now. I'm going to have to wrestle him. Big Ten and national. I'm not afraid to wrestle him, but I want to be a three-time national champion.
Kemp did not take a chance in the duel. It was at Michigan. He weighed in at 167. We would have to wait until the Big Ten tournament to see if a showdown would happen.
So if he enters the Big Ten tournament at 58, now we're going to throw down. Let's see what happens. Coach Dale Barr was pretty open about it, actually. He came and told me. He said, Kemp, I'll tell you what I told Mark. He said, only one of you is going to be a three-time national champion. Just remember that. Whatever decision you make, just think of that.
Chiarella cut to 150 for the Big Ten tournament, and both finished their careers with three NCAA titles. Hellickson was right. He never lost another collegiate match. His sophomore year was part of Wisconsin wrestling history when not only he, but two other Wisconsin wrestlers won NCAA titles. In his junior year, he beat second seed and very talented Kelly Ward 9-5. He was in his final match. For 4 years, Kemp had masterfully focused on each match minute by minute with an impenetrable foundation and the focus of the humble. But Kelly Ward had not won an NCAA title yet, and he was not laying down for Kemp. He seemed to lose his focus, wandering aimlessly in the last minute of the match.
Sometimes when you've had success like I've had, you could be a little arrogant about choking. Like, you know, how can you have a match like that where you're winning and you go, you know, it happened to me. I was winning and I just started to, you know, I could blame it on the official, blame it here. But still, the moment was getting to me. The official started getting in my ear. I don't know why I started to pay attention to the official.
Trailing and down in writing time, Ward took Kemp down and then let him go. Lee still had a 7-point advantage, 9-2, but had lost the momentum, and the official hit him for stalling twice in a short period of time, making the score 9-4.
I felt like I was in no man's land again. I wanted him to ride me a little bit. He just let me go. So now I'm on my feet, took me down again. I'm like, oh, crap, man.
Ward was closing in, now only down 9-6.
Then he had me in an arm bar and he's trying to turn me and the official's stalling, point. I was just totally off the rails. He lets me go again. I dive in. I grab his leg just to stall. Stalling, point. Then I let go and he gets me in an arm bar again. And then we're at the end of the match. A buzzer runs off. Two. He's like giving this guy points. And I'm like, I look at the score and it was like 9-8 or something like that. And I had riding time. I'm thinking, it was official just thinking he was going to be a hero, I think. I mean, I wasn't stalling. I mean, the guy was he was wrestling well. I mean, I give it to him. The guy wasn't going to give up. I gave him a little crack, a little opening, and he took it, man, and he was going to try to win that match. It's a shame that an official would do. I mean, I wasn't stalling. He was starting to beat me. Took me down and let me go. The only good thing about that match is that I won. I just walked off thinking, it was like a humbling experience. It was something that it was like a nightmare, like waking up from a nightmare.
The match was a nightmare, but the rest of his college career was a dream. Let's take a break with a message from one of wrestling's legends. When we come back, Lee Kemp begins the quest for the second part of his vision, an Olympic gold medal.
This is Mark Chiarella, a distinguished member inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1999. And you are listening to Etched in Stone, Stories of Wrestling Legends. The stories take you inside the lives of some of the greatest athletes ever with competitors, coaches, teammates, and those who knew these athletes best weigh in on their accomplishments with their own unique perspectives. Don't miss a single episode as the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling bring these stories to life. USA Wrestling provides quality opportunities for its members to achieve their full human and athletic potential and strives to be the world's best sports organization. To learn how you can become a member and download a complimentary storybook of all distinguished member stories, go to teamusa.org.
Just how good was Kemp in college? Russ Hellickson.
He was so driven to be at his peak level every time he performed. You never saw Lee wrestle a bad match. Matches were very consistent throughout his entire career, whether it was at high school or college or international. He performed pretty much the same way throughout. He had the same attitude throughout. He reacted to the victory the same way at the end. You know, ultimately, you knew he expected to be the winner. He wasn't going to lose. He was going to win. That's not something you can coach. That's something that he has figured out how to live by. And it's exceptional when you really see it happen. He wasn't out of position. He didn't bend over. He didn't concede things. He didn't have arms extended from him. He utilized the core position of wrestling from the first time he ever wrestled. He became exceptional at the high single leg. He became exceptional at the foot sweep. His core position was ideal. He never conceded hip position on anything. And what people don't realize is not so much his speed, but his quickness. His reaction to things was instantaneous and it was full power.
On his feet, Kemp took personal any attempt to take something from him, whether it was a takedown or victory. He had the unique ability to raise his intensity level to not only match yours, but he had the power on reserve for any time he needed to call on it. Once the flurry was over, he returned to tediously control the match. Kemp ended his college career a three-time NCAA champion and runner-up as a freshman. He had a 143-6-1 record, 110-1-1 his last 3 years, and had 47 pins. it was a foregone conclusion that Kemp would go for gold, apparent to everyone but him.
You know, the thing that's absolutely crazy for me, and I say this with all honesty, you know, I probably would look at him as being in my top four workout partners in my entire competitive career.
He beat the Russian in high school. He felled his hero, Dan Gable, on his way to three NCAA wrestling titles. They said his conservative style would hinder his success at the international level. But he won two world titles and was the most likely wrestler in the world to win gold in 1980.
I'd never liked wrestling freestyle after the season. And it's not that I want to take a break. I want to take a competition mental break. I love working out, but I didn't go on the open nationals, the freestyle nationals. So I didn't do a lot of wrestling like now. Man, these guys do. Man, they go to three, four events, even though they had their whole college season. Then they're going through, you know, they're going to the Euregan tournament. They're going to all these different events. I didn't do any of that.
His focus was always on the Olympics.
I mean, the world just wasn't at a level where none of us were really thinking about it like that. I don't think. I mean, it wasn't maybe like it is now, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it was important, but I was thinking more of the Olympics in 80, maybe. You know, I had a couple years to get ready. But when he said that, I'm going, coach. So I went.
Kemp was second-guessed his whole career. How could someone who scores so little continue to win, especially in freestyle, a style that rewards action? Gable was one of those doubters.
I wrestled 9 matches in 4 days, man. It was grueling. I had to wrestle Schultz and Joe Carr. They were in the mini tournament. And I had to beat both those guys. And this is one thing that Gable did, which was unusual. The mini tournament was the mini tournament. If you win that, now you're number 4 and you wrestle number 3. I beat Joe Carr 6-1, and I beat Dave Schultz 3-3 criteria, but I still won. I had like 3 activity points, maybe 2 activity points, maybe 1 stalling point, but 2 activity points. Dave had like maybe 1 takedown and 2 stalling points, whatever you call it, or passivity points. So most of Dave's points were passivity points. Most of my points were actual takedowns. That's why I won the criteria decision. Gable came up to me afterwards and said, "You have to wrestle Dave again in about an hour." But I didn't know any better. You know, Dan was a coach, and I said, okay. So I just started warming up again, and I wrestled, and I beat him 9-2. I was a little pissed because I knew it was a different precedent, but I knew that Dan, just through you hear things, you know, I knew they didn't think I'd be a good freestyle wrestler because of my style.
Kemp kept winning, beating Chiarella, then Yegla. He beat them all. Gable was starting to believe.
Dan took the pressure off of me. He said, "Lee, don't worry about anything other than just taking people down."
There were a lot of wrestlers in the room that had a lot more experience in freestyle than Kemp, especially on top.
So we worked on those positions and learning how not to get turned if I got taken down. And I don't think I scored any back points. I didn't turn anybody. But I didn't get turned either. It's just I got 1-point takedowns. Just take people down. That's all Dan said. And it clicked. Okay. It's no different. Just take people down. So I just would take people down. And that's kind of how I won.
Kemp did not waste any time asserting himself on the international stage. His first world championship competition was in Mexico City. A world title is as hard and sometimes more difficult to win than the Olympics. Wisconsin was well represented with both John Peterson and UW teammate Jim Haynes on the team. With Gable as coach, it meant that they would be in better shape than anyone in the world.
We did more intense. We did a lot of weightlifting then too. We did a lot of drilling, weightlifting, running. That myth of Gable, the way he trained and the way he trained his athletes.
In 1978, the finals were round robin. Kemp beat both Mojave from Iran and Marta from Russia. to become the youngest American to ever win a world title. That gave him a lift and more confidence in winning an Olympic gold medal.
Once I won the Worlds in 78, then I could see that I could be an Olympic champion. That was my dream. I just felt that I was good enough to win it. I just felt like that. But I was in an environment with people who were really good, and I was as good as they were. And I felt like Gable being the test, because he loved working out, and Desik was there, and everybody else was at that camp.
Kemp continued to train at a pace he set for himself until the grueling six-week camp and a showdown with a line of wrestlers looking to unseat him and take their place on the world team. He beat Mark Chiarella and Dave Schultz to make the team. Schultz was starting to catch up.
Dave was a very physical guy, even though he didn't look physical. Now, Mark, his brother, looked physical, and he was. Dave didn't look as athletic or as physical, but he was. He was strong, he had great leverage, and he didn't mind headbutting you a little bit, you know? So it was a brawl. He turned the match into a brawl. He tried to turn a match into wherever he could do to make, to give himself an advantage. A good competitor, didn't do anything wrong. I had gotten to a point where I could score and not be scored on. So when Dave scored on me, it was only because of the rules. Back then, if you were called for stalling or passivity, they'd give the other guy a point.
Competing in his second world championships in a much friendlier climate, San Diego, Kemp would find new challenges. Veteran German Martin Knops beat the Russian 9-1. Kemp beats the Russian by 2. Knops wins all of the first 3 flurries and is up by 2. He shot a low sweeping single. A wrestler with a shot like that was continuously susceptible to Kemp's attack.
I watched, and I don't even scramble. And my instincts were just the right instincts. I was able to not get scored on in that scramble situation. And I can tell that frustrated him. So I took a lot out of him because we scrambled quite a bit in that. And my conditioning was always very good. And then he gets in again on a kind of a scramble, kind of a shot. And I am scoring on him after I avoided his takedown. I took him down. I could tell that was frustrating. Then he got in one more time on like a scramble type setting. And I won that scramble. So the score was end up, it was 6-2. But I think it was like 3-2. He was winning 3-2 at first. But then those last points that I scored were just him being totally frustrated. I knew he was good. So that set that rivalry up.
John Bardis was there for that match.
Vorobyev was an extremely tough leg rider. He was really tough on top. He was long. He was had great hips. He was extremely flexible. And his matches with any other American were rarely close. But with Lee, Lee always with Vorobyev, and the world championship was the same. Lee basically looked at the clock. I think he was down a caution and with something like 37 seconds left. And this happened over and over and over again in the rivalry. No matches were won by Vorobyev. All the matches were won by Lee. Lee took him down, hit him with a single, finished it with a double, and won the world title.
From 1971 to 1980, when I was trying to make and perform in international competition, Lee was very, very difficult to score on. He was even harder to turn on the wrestling mat.
It wasn't an injury. Dave Schultz did not bring him down. He managed every detail of his rise, but he could not control the President of the United States. It was difficult to see someone so talented who gave up everything in his life to pursue one moment in life, a gold medal at the Olympics, get his heart ripped open by inconsequential politics. But that's what was next for Lee Kemp. Etched in Stone is an exclusive production of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame and USA Wrestling. Download your free souvenir book of Legend on the Rocks or any of the Etched in Stone stories produced at the NationalWrestlingHallOfFame.org. The storybook includes the written story and is filled with pictures and videos of their live matches. This will be the first of many storybooks produced about these legends. Start your collection now. And while you are on the National Wrestling Hall of Fame site, take a deeper dive into the profiles of the 179 distinguished members inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.